Welcome to The Hobcast, a weekly podcast from Hoback Books, an independent publisher of thrillers, crime, and suspense novels. Each week, we'll take you behind the scenes of what we do, the challenges and the triumphs, the bumps and troughs of building a new creative business in this pandemic world. We'll hear from the people who make all this possible, the authors, cover designers, and editors, and we'll have expert insights from our guest star interviews. Nothing is off the agenda on The Hobcast from Hoback Books, as we combined trad values and an indie spirit.
Hello, hello, hello.
Welcome to The Hobcast book show.
That threw you.
It totally has. We'll explain that reference in a moment. But anyway, welcome to The Hobcast book show. My name is Adrian Hobart.
And my name is Rebecca Collins.
And together we run Hoback Books, UK independent publishers of the following four genres.
Thrillers.
Mysteries.
Suspense.
And crime. Welcome along to the show. Our guest this week is Stuart DeBar from...
SRL Publishing.
SRL Publishing. They're fellow members of the Indie Press Network, newly founded, and pioneers of green publishing in the sense that they are... extremely conscious of the global imprint they could make with their publishing.
It's an interesting story, so please do listen.
Yeah, Stuart, it's a really fascinating interview. And again, you know, we've been speaking to a few publishers recently, and this is because, you know, our network has expanded to about 50 different independent publishers that we're all sort of connected, and we're sharing so much at the moment because we're talking about the smaller publishers, less than five people employed by them, including ourselves, at the micro end of the publishing.
I think that is actually the term, isn't it? Micro publishers.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, we like to call ourselves a small publisher, but actually there is a level below, and that's us, really, because the two of us, with the brilliant talents of our authors and our wonderful co-conspirators in...
That's you, Jane Mapp.
Yes, principally. But, you know, we've got a lot of people, and Sue, who does a lot of our editing. And, you know, we have a small little, team, platoon of people working towards everything that we do at Hoback. But essentially, it's the two of us at its heart. And it's, you know, being such small publishers, the smallest little thing can bounce you way off the tracks or into trouble or whatever. The difficulties at every corner.
But actually, also the opposite. So a good example
is true.
Malcolm Holland Drake's box set.
Yeah.
Books 1 to 2. This week, we did a 99p deal for it. So, and it shot to number one in its category in Australia.
Yeah, and it's been his highest ranking book in or release in Australia.
And in the overall Kindle store as well.
Yeah,
I can't remember the number, but it was quite high.
Yeah, no, fantastic. And we've had other strong sales, and indeed, as The Edge of the Land comes out very, very soon.
Yes, tomorrow.
Tomorrow, in fact. pre-orders for Malcolm's latest book in the Merseyside trilogy have also been very strong. So, you know, there are many things that give you an uplift as well. But I think what the Indie Press Network is offering is insights, new ways of thinking, opportunities that people have already explored, new suppliers, different ways of organizing your model, if you like, in the way that you do things, and sharing and actually having that kinship in the sense of, oh, yeah, that happened to us, or yeah, Amazon did that to us too, and we got out of it this way, or just having the ear of each other, because it's a very lonely process if you don't have that. And it's been enormously valuable. And that's what will shine through in our interview with Stuart a little bit later. So listen out for that. We'll get to our news section now. And guess what? Those two little letters are going to shine through in the two stories that we've picked out for this week.
Two little letters.
What could they be?
FB for Facebook?
No.
No, it's of course it is. AI.
AI. Which...
But interesting stories, though.
Yeah, very, very interesting. So you'll kick off with our first one, which was featured in The Guardian.
Yes.
And the essence of this is there's been some whistleblowing going on.
Yes.
I'll just set the context, if I may, just a little. We talked a lot about it over the last 18 months, was that the prospect of Simon & Schuster, one of the big five, being bought by another of the big five, Penguin Random House, and that got blocked in the United States.
Mm.
And when that got blocked, another mega media company, not necessarily known for its publishing, started to circle Simon & Schuster. You take it away.
Yes. So, yes, exactly. Another big company, Meta. So Meta, I believe, is a company that controls Facebook, Instagram.
Yes.
What's it called? Threads?
Yeah. It's basically Mark Zuckerberg.
Yes.
And his empire, yes.
So it came out last week that Meta were in discussions at that time when Simon & Schuster was sort of on the market, so to speak. So Meta were also in discussions with Simon & Schuster to join forces. Now, you know, on paper that sounds fine, but it's been revealed that they had plans. So their plan was to train the company's, so Meta's artificial intelligence tools to, you know what I mean, put books into it.
So basically they wanted all of Simon & Schuster's IP.
Yes.
To be able to feed it into the machine.
Yes.
Their AI generative AI language models.
And to train it. Now, it's not exactly clear what they were going to do, but it's sort of the insidiousness of this.
Well, yeah, absolutely. And the explanation was, and this has come from employees who were aware of what was going on and the discussions. And the discussion was along the lines of, well, look, we've already nicked everything that we can open source on the media, the internet, and shoved it into our machine, but we need more. The machine needs more feeding. And they saw that as an opportunity to buy Simon & Schuster effectively and take control of the IP. And this was presumably going to be done without the consent of the authors yet again.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the thing, isn't it? I mean, it was just in the discussion stage, so there was nothing set out. But people who knew about this thought, wait a minute, there's ethical considerations here. And so it didn't happen, obviously, but, you know, beggars belief, really.
Well, I like the line in the article was saying, when people raised the question of ethical considerations, it was met with blank faces from
met with silence. It
met
says,
with silence
fact, yeah.
from Meta and indeed from certain executives at Simon & Schuster.
They just didn't think that was a consideration at all.
Well, that's the problem, isn't it? I mean, that is, and it's hard because basically, philosophically, those companies, and we're talking about a lot of big companies here who've been doing this, the AI thing, do not respect copyright law at all. One, do not understand why there's an objection to it, and only see their own goals and needs as being, you know, the only thing that counts in this. And so for all of us on the creative side, for whom owning the copyright and protecting that copyright is the basis of their income, it is deeply worrying. And, you know, it feeds into what we were discussing about what happened with Findaway Voices sliding in a change to their contracts so that they could feed the Apple machine in terms of narrators' voices that other people had paid for. You know, no permission for the narrators themselves, no permission from the real permission from the authors of those works, and no recompense.
No.
So that's fed into that. Now, I have a story which sort of takes this on a little, if I may.
You may.
Which was in the bookseller, as usual. But this is a survey from the Society of Authors, who've been really busy doing surveys recently.
Yeah, but they're good surveys, aren't
they?
Generally,
they are. So this is a survey of 787 members. I think it's possibly the same survey they did last week, which they revealed, you know, that people were getting burnt out in the industry,
yes,
and all that sort of thing.
That.
Something like that. Anyway, it's found that a third of translators and a quarter of illustrators have lost work to generative artificial intelligence systems. Translators are more likely to use AI to support their work, with 37% of respondents saying they have done so, followed by 25% of non-fiction writers. So those are people using AI.
Oh, okay.
But they're also saying that they've been losing work to it. The research explores the experiences of those in creative careers with AI systems and their views and concerns about the future impact on creative careers. The survey's respondents included writers of fiction and non-fiction, scriptwriters and poets, both traditionally and self-published, as well as journalists, illustrators and translators. Illustrators are the least likely to have used AI in their work, with only 1 in 10 reporting having made use of its systems, compared to a fifth of fiction writers and a quarter of non-fiction writers. Meanwhile, around 3 in 10 illustrators and writers say they have used generative AI to brainstorm ideas, while 8% of translators and an even smaller proportion of illustrators, 5%, report that the reason they have used AI in their work is because they were asked by a publisher or commissioning organisation to do so. The responses also reveal that over 1/3 of illustrator respondents and 4 in 10 translators have seen the income from their work decrease in value because of generative AI. Looking ahead, more than 80% of respondents say they are concerned about AI output mimicking their style and that the use of generative AI devalues human-made creative work.
Well, it's inevitable. I mean, you know, it's one of those surveys that you just think, well, that's no surprise, is there, at all?
Well, it's in the category of something Sherlock. but at the same time, yeah, it's inevitable. But is it welcome? No.
No.
That's... Is it something that needs to be addressed? Yes. Is it something... I mean, we are going through a revolution. Unfortunately, you know, the creative industries have always been largely underpaid. There are the outliers who make a lot of money through a combination of factors why they do. But ultimately, and this was at the centre as well of the recent screenwriters strike in Hollywood, is that so many aspects of Hollywood production, for instance, are being given over to generative AI, including writing beat sheets and skeletons, and even whole screenplays are being done. Actors' performances are being replaced now by generative AI characters, and especially in things like video games and stuff like that. So there's an awful lot of a movement to basically replace the human in the creative process as much as possible in order to generate profits. And I go back to the point I've made for the last few weeks, which is this. The only way this turns around, and this has happened in movies and to some extent, is people saying, do you know what? I don't want to watch stuff that was just made by a computer or, you know, an artificial intelligence system. You know, no matter how much it hits the beats, it has no soul, for instance, you might argue. And this has happened, I say, in the way that computer-generated imagery has become, there's been a sort of retrofication of that because people don't want to watch what the computers can throw at the screen in a Marvel film or a Star Wars film. They want to see what was done before, which was using models and the physical process. And, you know, they want to feel that humans be more involved in it than the computer.
But isn't this you know, this has happened throughout history with any innovation. So, for example, music. You have innovations in music and people return to vinyl.
They are now, yes. They are, very much so. Some vinyl outsells CDs, yeah.
Even in TV and films, people... there's a certain sector of society that returns to sort of old-school filmmaking and old-school...
Well, I think the fact that the Polaroid is now a thing again.
Yes, that's another good example. And art as well, you know, there's a return to the techniques of the masters. You do see that as well. So would that possibly apply with AI? We'll have a honeymoon period where suddenly there's lots of things available in it and there's some amazing technology. You know, for example, that idea that AI can cater to what Adrian Hobart likes to watch and create something just for you.
Mm.
But then there will be that rebellion again of people saying, actually, no, we want to go back. We want to feel the soul of these things.
I feel conflicted because I was watching something that made me tickled me a little bit this week on YouTube, where somebody's gone into to the trouble of AI generating 1950s versions of the trailers for Star Wars, so that it's in sort of 70, it's that sort of look that a 50s sci-fi film would have.
And, yes.
And they've done sort of retro voicing and stuff like that, and the it tickles me. It's quite inventive, but at the same time it is candy floss, really. You know, it doesn't move the world. It just entertained me.
But that's somebody using AI to create art. So it's still got the human element to it. It's still got the creative thought in that person's head.
Oh,
so.
No, absolutely. No, you're right. And I think back to when I started off as a journalist, when the newsrooms I worked in, we all had to use typewriters because we didn't have word processing systems at that stage.
And Josh, my middle son, is a perfect example of...
He's just bought himself a typewriter
because he loves the act of typing. He loves the feel of it. He just likes the sort of idea of being this...
I have to say, though, typewriting under pressure for somebody to read on air and fearing that, you know, if you had too many cross-outs and whatever, it would make it unreadable. It was a nightmare. I mean, you know, technology improved my life exponentially.
So that's an example of where you've used the tools of technology for the better for
look, your... And if it weren't for technology and all the things, like, we wouldn't be able to podcast right now from where we are on our sofa at Hoback Towers.
In our jammies.
Yeah. You know, with a device that's the size of a tricorder, which
looks
can put
like
four
a...
microphones. You know, it's you know, all of that stuff that would have been a full studio needed.
So what I would like people to just consider the possibility that AI, if monitored properly and policed properly and developed with consideration, will actually be, at some point, a tool for the good.
Right. Who's going to regulate it? Who's going to bring in in that element? You know, we've got the robber barons running it at the moment.
At the moment, yes.
And so, you know, that's where the problem lies. And I think the story you had with Simon & Schuster, and indeed the one that I've just said, you know, the survey of people losing work at a quite alarming rate, really, is where the concerns lie. Anyway, look, we talk about this every week, it seems. We'll find some stories for next week, of course.
We need something fluffy and happy.
At some point, we'll find some. Anyway, let's speak to Stuart DeBar from...
SRL Publishing.
And SRL, members of the Indie Press Network, and they have such an eclectic range of books. You know, you could not label SRL, nail them to any particular style or genre or anything like that. It's got quite a broad church, but at its heart, they are the pioneers of green publishing, in the sense that, for instance, every time they print a book, they plant a tree, basically.
Now, I've got this image of Stuart in the garden planting these trees.
No, well, I mean, they've offset their printing needs beyond what they actually use. They've been planting, so this is a big thing. But also, it's about finding printers that are going to use the least destructive chemicals. The paper needs to be sourced from FSC sources, all sorts of aspects to reduce their carbon footprint. And that's at the heart of what they do. And, you know, it doesn't come cheap, as Stuart will explain to us. So here's Stuart DeBar. Big pleasure to speak to Stuart DeBar from SRL Publishing. Thank you so much for joining us, Stuart.
No, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, there are many things we want to talk to you about, but let's go straight to the nub of what makes your company different from almost any other in the publishing world, and that's your eco-credentials and the emphasis and work that you put in to make sure that in publishing books, you're leaving the least trace on the planet as possible.
Yeah.
What was your motivation for going down that route?
I don't know. it started, so we published a kid's book, more than that now, about a gibbon that loses his home to deforestation. And through that, we teamed up with Rainforest Trust, and we donated some of our profits and everything to one of their projects that was saving trees in the Amazon in Peru. and I think at the end of the year, we managed to, I think it was something like 2,500 acres of rainforest that had been protected, which works out between 500,000 and 750,000 trees that we'd saved.
Wow. That's amazing. And then,
yeah, I was very shocked at that answer, but yeah, it's incredible. And then that kind of got me thinking, like, well, the industry that we work in, obviously, we know that we cut down trees for paper. Paper obviously comes from trees and nowhere else, and we need trees for our work, basically. And then I was kind of thinking, like, rather than just saving trees, because trees are still being cut down, then look into the numbers of trees that are being cut down, the number of wastage in the industry, and we kind of just evolved from there. And then we kind of looked into, obviously, replacing the trees that we've used. And then it kind of turned into offsetting our carbon emissions. And then in June 2020, we became a climate positive publisher. And after about 3 or 4 years of research, we were the only one out there who said we offset more than we emit, which is, again, I was very shocked at that, to be fair. Yeah, it's kind of just evolved from there, really.
I can, one of the things that stood out when I was reading, you know, the information you've got on your website about this is just how staggeringly huge the number of books that are getting pulped every year. So, you know, people are doing print runs and they're printing more than they need because the unit cost comes down so much.
Yeah.
If they print, you know, from our case, if we do a print run, it's never really more than 200 books.
No, that's the most.
Because we know that it's going to be, you know, that's, occasionally we're going to run out and yeah. But you know, but if you're going into the thousands where you get the savings, the chances are you're not going to sell every one of those books. Yeah. And that then gets to the point where if the works won't sell them in this country, they're going to land, they're going to get pulped what is the overall figure, because it's in the millions, isn't it?
So the figures that I've got were from the Publishers Association and Nielsen, and they both came up with the same figure. And this was, granted, it was about 10 years ago, and we would hope that the industry has changed and evolved and been brought into the 21st century. It was something around 77 million books in the UK alone.
That's incredible.
77 million remainder books.
Yeah.
Pulps.
Yeah.
Each year in yeah. 10 years ago. Wow.
Yeah, in the UK. So just imagine what that figure is like.
I was going to say US, worldwide.
In Australia.
Yeah.
I think it was the UK and Amsterdam randomly. UK and Netherlands randomly. I don't know why they chose to have those two together, but it's staggering. And I did an article for the bookseller about a year and a half ago for their climate issue, and I worked out how many trees that was, and it was a good couple of million trees.
Oh, wow.
Basically, like you say, have been cut down, turned into paper, and then turned into books, shipped around the world, because let's face it, a lot of publishers print in the Far East because, again, it's cheaper.
Cheaper, yeah.
Yeah, and then they know, like you said, Adrian, that you know that they know that they're going to get pulled. They just do it because it's bigger profit margins, which is a shame.
Well, it's a catch 22 for publishers, small publishers like ourselves, you know.
Yeah.
That those print runs that actually bring economies of scale tie up a lot of money, and they're not easy to do. And we're not in that game. I mean, you know, economically, we're not in that game because we can't afford to do the four figure plus print runs. Mm. But at the same time, you know, we look jealously at the margins that the bigger publishers can do, and that, you know, the fact that they can sell and make a profit on books sold into supermarkets at £5 a pop, yeah, to retail, because they're using really cheap paper and they're printing such monumental huge runs that, you know, each copy costs, you know, maybe a quid at most.
I don't know, yeah.
Whereas, you know, when we're doing print on demand or whatever, we're now looking at prices of £4, £5 for a paperback, which, you know, yeah, prices is out of the market. So we're in a, you know, we'd like to be more eco-friendly, but at the same time, the economics of printing and the industry as a whole work against us.
But then isn't print on demand economically friendly because you're not storing books, you're not...
Well, I mean, that's a question for Stuart.
Yeah. Right?
It theoretically it should be, but then again, you know, when I mean, I don't know who you use, but we don't use Amazon, but for the likes of Amazon, I can't imagine, and I know this has obviously gone public and I don't really care what I say.
don't worry about it. We often say things about Amazon.
we all know that they're not exactly the most ethical company out there, right? We all know that they're wasted and what they want and what they do isn't what should be done. So I can only imagine the likes of Amazon's print on demand isn't really that good quality and isn't as ethical as you say. But there are some out there that are, and they do use like FSC certified paper, which is obviously got chain of custody, all that sort of stuff. And you know, they don't use pulp that is from trees from like endangered growth forests and all this lot. So it's getting better. I wouldn't say we're in a position where we can say like, you know, the industry is amazing, we're where we should be. But I think if you look at the progress of the last few years, it's definitely on the right track at least. But as you were saying about the financial side of it, with every debate, I always try and see both sides. So I completely understand, obviously, from a business point of view, you need to make profit, right? That's what we're here for. We're here for the love of books and to make profit. But like you say, trying to balance the two together is a catch-22 situation, because it's like, okay, so I need to make some money, but I also need to print books to make money. So obviously, if you're going to try and print them as cheap as you can, but it's one of those things, isn't it? It's trying to find the right balance, and yeah, we're always tipping one way or the other, or falling completely off the scale, to be fair.
Well, yeah, quite often that. I mean,
on the floor.
What's it been like being, you know, in a way, one of the few voices that is being listened to in this field, because you've published The Bookseller. I know you've talked at various events as well.
Yeah.
And how receptive is the industry in a wider sense, do you think, to the message that you're passing on?
It's mixed. It's completely mixed. From what I've experienced and what I've seen from people's reactions, you know, people like when I say to publishers, like, you're overprinting for profit, why are you doing that? And you get ignored, basically, because they know they shouldn't be doing it, but they're doing it because they've got a board of directors to please. Yeah. This is what I was talking about. I went to the Publishers Association office last week and I was talking to someone there about it. And she was saying, small businesses like ours, we don't have a board of directors who are breathing down our necks, wanting the biggest margins and the biggest profit. You know, we can do what we feel is right. I feel that it's the people who are higher up in the corporate industry are the ones who are against it and the ones who are hunting for profit. But then I feel like on the other side of that, there's a lot of authors, a lot of, how to say this in a nice way, people who work in publishing. There's a lot of people who work in publishing who are wanting their businesses to do that. Even those who work for like Penguin and all the other big publishers. There's a lot of people out there who want their publishers to be seen to be doing the right thing and actually doing it, not just say they're doing it.
Yeah,
there's a difference.
Yeah. I mean, looking at that then as a whole, I mean, given that there's pressure coming from within, at the lower level, within big publishers and from authors, where does the imperative need to come from? Because I sometimes wonder whether it's the consumer refusing to buy books that can't carry the certification, yeah. You know, FSC certification, for instance, or, you know, not buying from publishers who cannot reach a certain criteria of environmental sustainability. Is it going to be a customer-led thing, or is it that sort of revolution from within? Because what we're learning, even last week we were talking on the podcast about how staff themselves feel exploited. There was this survey suggesting that 97% of respondents had suffered burnout. They're not getting paid enough to
Not even to live on.
So, you know, they're getting exploited. And so therefore, you know, there is this feeling that their voices are not heard even on those fundamental aspects of, you know, employer and employee relationships. That, you know, so a green message is going to be very hard to push through if they're not even getting paid properly.
Yeah, you're right. You're spot on. Because if a publisher or the big bosses aren't listening to their colleagues about things, about pay, working environment, their rights, they ain't going to listen to their colleagues about environment, are they? It's probably one of the lowest things on their priority list to try and tackle, unless they do it for PR.
True.
Yeah.
True. But then, you see, that's a lot of what, you know, we've seen in recent years. Let's say in the drive for human diversity and indeed subject matter.
Yes.
Publishers have woken up to the fact that most of their authors were from a certain demographic background, and therefore they, they were shamed into doing something about that. And indeed, the breadth of subject matter that they tackled before is broadening because of pressure from outside. Mm. So, you know, at what stage will those triggers start to have an impact on publishing as a whole?
I think with anything, when any company makes a decision, I mean, we've all been on Twitter when somebody tweets about, like, I don't know if you remember the whole Yorkie, not for a man kind of, not for a woman kind of thing, just for a man, or the whole Kleenex man-sized tissues. It takes just one person to tweet about, say, one of the big publishers. So a thing of mine, so I recently bought Bill Clinton's book, How to Solve a Planet Crisis or something. I can't remember what it is.
Yeah.
I bought that online, and it came wrapped in plastic. And I was like, this is, I've bought, obviously I'm getting you guys are big readers as well. I bought a lot of books, and that was the very first book that came wrapped in plastic. And I was a bit like, oh, that's for a climate book. That's very bizarre. Mm-hmm. Because it wasn't, it felt like that really horrible, unrecyclable plastic that was just crap. And then I looked on the copyright page. It was published by Penguin. I don't care. And it said, we're a sustainable publisher. And then a few lines down on the copyright page, it says, printed in India. And I was like, that's not really the right way about doing that, surely. But it's, I think it takes a scandal. That's literally all it takes. It'll take someone who's well-known, I guess, on Twitter to post something and say, oh, this is not right, blah, blah, blah. And then they'll have their internal meetings and then something will change. That's how these big companies evolve, I guess. It's not going to come down from the top, is it? Because let's face it, all they want is bigger bonuses, bigger profits, and that's all they care about.
Yeah, so it's about reputation in that case, isn't it? It's protecting their reputation.
Okay, but it takes me back to your position with your company, in the sense that we're talking about profit, and you know, we're small publishers, Hoback and yourselves, and this is, profit is something that
it's not our main driving force.
Well, let's put it this way: it can't be, because it's elusive enough as it is.
It doesn't exist.
So you know, we're fighting for survival every time, and every month almost it feels like, you know, some months will be better than others, but it's still tough. So you've committed on your website to putting your profits back into sort of sustainable production, which and you know, obviously offsetting with carbon offsetting with trees and things like that. Mm. So how tough is it to stay true to those principles, you know, given that, you know, you've got to keep the money coming in?
Do you know what? Like you just said, we're all struggling. We're all going through a very hard time at the moment, and it is tough. I mean, in the last 18 months, we all heard about smaller publishers closing down, unfortunately, yep. Which is just horrible. The price of, like, planting trees and offsetting carbon emissions has risen by a good 200-300% in the last couple of years.
Wow.
So it is a struggle. It really is a struggle. But when I look at our tree planting thing, so we try and plant the number of trees that we've used at least, but we've planted way more. So even if we have a year where we don't plant trees for about 6 months, we've still got trees that we've already planted that we can kind of soak up, I guess.
So you're in credit, in a sense.
Yeah. Trees.
Yeah, it sounds wrong saying that, but like you say, we need to exist, and if that's a decision we have to take, then we'll take it. I have said, and we have said as a company, that we will never overprint books for profit.
Mm.
We've put that publicly. I'm not sure if it's on our website, but it probably should be. But we have said that we will never be one of those publishers that puts profit as their main driver, and we will never overprint books just for profit, you know, even knowingly that half of them will probably be thrown in the bin, unfortunately.
Mm. No, I think that's a good message. I actually don't think that many people know about the overprinting.
Well, they didn't.
Readers, I mean.
No, I think it's publishing, one of publishing's dirty little secrets, isn't it? And and I think that certainly within our company, you know, we have this constant debate whether we're going to do a print run. based on whether we think the popularity of the book is going to sustain it, so that you're not going to be left, even with a 200 copy print run, 100 books sitting on a shelf somewhere.
Yeah.
That's one calculation. The other is, at any given time, whether we've actually got enough money in the bank to tie up, 800-900 quid in a print run like that, and then see the books sit in a warehouse and cost us X amount every month to sit there until they get picked up through gardeners and sold into bookshops. So those are calculations that we're always making. But actually, it really makes sense to go down the... If print on demand was more competitive, if retailers weren't so squeamish about buying print on demand, which some of them are.
Yeah, some of them still are, aren't they? They don't like them.
And they, you know, they only ordered what they knew they could sell, as opposed to...
Well, they can with print on demand.
Well, yeah, but they don't like to make that decision. They like publishers to send them a dozen copies and then with the right to send back 9 of them. You know, that's the way they work. So do you think bookshops, going on to that point, need to do more in this space?
Oh, that's a tricky question. Nick? No. Do you know what? We all love bookshops. We all support independent bookshops, and quite rightly so, because they are the ones who champion our books, maybe more than we do or can. If I'm being completely honest, I would say yes, because like you said a minute ago, we've sent, say, 15, 20 books to a bookshop and they've returned 10 or 12. And, you know, you struggle to try and ship them on somewhere else and they're just sitting there. And if every bookshop in the country did that, or even 100, you've got, like you said, you've got a big warehouse of books just sitting there that you're then trying to pass on to other bookshops or other... And it is tough. I guess, you know, like you said, if bookshops maybe just ordered a small handful and then sold them and then reordered them when they sell out or whatever, or just kept even 2 or 3 in stock, then, and again, even if 100 bookshops started doing that, it would make a massive difference to us both in sales and revenue, surely.
Absolutely, it would, yeah.
And returns would drop and we wouldn't have that pressure of, oh, I've got all these books that have been returned, you know, I need to try and get rid of them. And then when you've got more releases coming out and your warehouse space is minimal, you've got to make that decision of, what do I do with these books that I can't sell, but then I've got a new release coming out and I need to make room for that one. It's tough. It's tough for all of us, to be fair. But yeah, I think they do need to do a bit more. If we have an honest conversation about it.
Yeah, it's one we need to start, I think. But you know, I guess that one of the challenges for indie publishers is getting in there in the first place.
Yeah.
So, you know, adding an extra element of, and by the way, don't overorder from us because of the environment, might turn them off touching those books in the first
place.
Well,
I don't know. It's difficult, isn't it? Because I do think that some bookshops would be open to moving in this direction.
I've no doubt they would. But economically, they're clinging on as well. You know, under pressure from the bigger retailers who can demand and, you know, bigger retail discounts for their books, special signed editions, all that stuff they're up against. I mean, it's an interesting debate, isn't it? So let's move on to the breadth of the offer that you've got from SRL. We talked about the valuable and pioneering work you're making in the environmental space. But in terms of philosophically, what you're looking for from an SRL title, what is it that you publish in terms of the range, and what is it that underpins, you know, your choice of titles to publish?
If I come across a submission and I like it and it's got a good story, then we'll publish it.
And you're nodding. Us,
you're both smiling and nodding, so that is exactly the same everywhere else, really. Well, the big guys don't like taking on risks, but we do. We do have like a what we call a break in the silence theme, where we, not all of our books, but a lot of them, they try to tackle some issues that don't always get spoken about. And we all struggle with mental health. We're all aware of the stigma that surrounds mental health, especially, you know, not to call out any gender, but especially in male mental health and open up conversations. So we've published books that try to open up conversations and get people talking about bereavement in the family or depression in children or mental health or sexual assault, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
In terms of genres, it's a bit of everything, to be fair. We've done picture books, not recently, but in the past we've done picture books. We've done young adult, new adult, LGBT. We've done literary fiction. We've done a historical fiction, which I couldn't turn down, even though we don't really publish historical. We do have a lot of thrillers. I'm not going to lie. I love to be thrilled. I love to be thrilled. And when I'm looking for a thriller, you know, when like you tweet about like your manuscript wish list, I'm always like, I need a thriller that like grabs me up by the throat and slams me against the door. I need a really exciting, can't put down kind of thriller. I want to be there till midnight reading the submission because I enjoy it that much.
Yeah,
thriller, yeah. So we have a bathwater test. If I read a submission in the bath, and if the water goes cold, because I can't stop reading. It's a good one.
That's a very good test, that, actually. And I love a bath. I might try that.
Well, it was you know, very similar. Michael Caine and, certainly Michael Caine. I'm trying to remember the other. Bob Hoskins both used to apply that. If the script came in and they were still on the toilet and they got a cold bum, then they phone up their agent and say, yeah, I'm interested.
That's brilliant. So, do you guys publish books that have been previously published? Have you taken
some of them? Yeah, some of our books have.
Yeah,
I just thought I'd ask a random question there. Yeah, no, I just because we get quite a few submissions that ask us the same thing, and I'm always thinking like, do other publishers do that? Because we do if we like it enough.
It's the same sort of thing. If it passes the bathwater test,
I think there's a lot. There's an interesting situation in the publishing world at the moment, which is quite a number of authors get dropped.
Yeah.
And one of the things that we're keen to change in our relationship with our authors is to, you know, they have the option to leave us, which a couple have out of the 25 we've signed to date for various reasons. But by and large, we're sticking by them because, you know, we've gone through the cold water, you know, bath test. And, you know, it's a big commitment when you sign up an author. And I think that, you know, you're investing in their hopes as well. Now, you can't always fulfill what their dreams are in terms of sales. It's particularly difficult to sustain that because increasingly this marketplace is a pay-to-play environment where you know, if you don't have the marketing spend, if you don't get the targeting right and make a profit, which is very easy to lose money on Amazon and Facebook very, very quickly, then, you know, it's tough. And so a lot of people are out there either looking for a publisher having been self-published or being rejected by a traditional publisher having been there for some years and then they've got to find a home and they're not comfortable publishing themselves. So, yeah, I mean, it's wrong, to, I think, to drop these titles if you believe in the author.
Yeah, same. I feel the same. And especially with the whole Grantham distribution closing next year, I think it is. And we've taken on two or three authors who were affected by that because their books are brilliant. Their books deserve to be out there, and it's not fair that they've worked so hard in writing their book, rewriting it, drafting it, editing it, going through, like you said, going through the whole publication process, and then like a year later, it's like, oh no, we don't have the space for your book in our warehouse. Oh, you're gonna have to terminate your contract, and then that's it, and then they're left having to go through the whole querying process again, which is stressful enough. So yeah, we have taken on a few as well, and we will in the future.
Yeah, same. Yeah.
I mean, I think that, you know, one of the things about publishing though is that there's never going to be a shortage of authors, and that's tough for authors in the sense that there are an awful lot of...
There are more fishes in the sea than there were 10 years ago.
And there are far fewer places in which to put your books in terms of, you know, traditional lists are narrower than ever. Mm. And you have to have a certain set of criteria to qualify for publication now. And it's not necessarily whether your book's any good. That's no longer enough.
What's your media following? How famous are you?
Exactly.
Yeah.
One thing I really despise about this industry.
Oh, it's terrible, isn't it? It's heartbreaking when you see another celebrity with their new cozy crime series.
Yeah. And you think, have you even written that? Like, has some poor sod been sitting in the back room typing up for you, writing it, and then, or what I imagine happens, which probably does, you know, an author submits their work to a big publisher and the publisher's like, okay, well, you've got 100 followers on Twitter. Why don't we add this name to it?
I think
that that's very, very prevalent, and I think that it's one of the things. But it takes me to a point, Stuart, where I ask myself and you, you know, given all those things that work against us as small publishers, and indeed against everybody in the industry, the cynicism of it, what keeps you coming back to do more?
Yeah, we ask ourselves this every day.
I don't know. I think it's just that the passion for storytelling and the passion for like how powerful reading a book is. I don't think people realise how powerful it can be. No, I don't know the answer to that. I don't actually know. I mean, what is it for you two? What brings you back every day? What gets you
very similar? Yeah, it's. I just love books. I always have ever since I was could pick a book up. I think I knew I was going to work in publishing. I was writing my own books and sending them off to HarperCollins when I was five. Yeah. So I'm getting these lovely letters back.
I think there is something beautiful about bringing a great story into the world or a book of any description that you know, it all has merit. As long as it's not AI driven or, you know, all the things we're knocking. But yeah. I think that's part of it. I think that when you get, you know, I don't know about you, when you get a delivery of physical copies and you rip open the box and you see them for the first time, there's nothing beats that feeling.
No. In fact, we had a box this morning just for the podcast, and I did the same. I said, open the
I've just had my catalogues for, I'm going to Bologna Book Fair next week, and I've just had my catalogues delivered, and I got excited looking at them.
I love catalogues, because I love the smell of them.
Oh, yeah. So fresh and so clean. Yeah, we had one of our thriller books. We hadn't even released the cover yet, but I wanted to just take a picture and post it on social media, but I refrained. So I was so excited. Yeah, seeing our books in print and actually seeing our author's response to seeing their books in print, you know, when we send them their author copies or a proof copy and just seeing their reaction, I think that makes it a lot worthwhile.
Yeah, because you're kind of like a dream facilitator. You're making people's dreams come true.
Yes, I mean, you know, I think that initial dream is easy. It's relatively easy to satisfy. I think what's hard is making those books stand out in a very congested marketplace and reach enough people to, you know, once you've gone over the excitement of, oh, I'm a published author, what next? It's that next stage.
That is
the challenge that we constantly feel here, is that responsibility. And some books fly and some books don't so much.
And sometimes it's not because one is a better book than another book. There's so many reasons why
in a sense that imponderable, the thing that has always been in publishing, where, you know, one successful book can sustain the other 10 on the list. It's still a factor. And it's one of the things that annoys me most about publishing is that, I suppose, one of its joys is it's unpredictable, totally unpredictable.
Massively. You can't. This is what we say on our website. You can't predict how well a book will sell. You can't predict if it's going to sell 10 copies, 10,000 copies. You just don't know. I think a lot of it is just the timing of publication. I mean, I don't know about you guys, but we obviously prepare our books months in advance, and we've got books scheduled in for the next year, 18 months, and that date is set, and that's what we work towards. But like, in a year, the industry will be so different, and the topics that are in conversation now will be tomorrow's chip paper. Everybody will be talking about something else that's going on in the world, and it's about timing. It's, you know, if you time a book right and you get it out there just as that topic is in the news and very topical and very spoken about, then yeah, your book will fly. But if it was a topic that was like 6 months, a year ago, then it might not do as well. And it's not like you say, it's not any fault of ours. It's not any fault of the author. It is what it is, unfortunately. That's the way the cookie crumbles, as they say.
Yeah, it is. It's and it's very hard to have those conversations where, you know, everyone's put their best efforts in and not necessarily reap the rewards that one would hope or expect. But that's the nature of the game. But at the same time, every time I say that, I feel like I'm making an apology.
I know, I do it every day.
But,
Yeah, it's really hard because they're so, some of our authors are so emotional about it, understandably.
Yeah,
but it's really hard to then put a business spin back to them and say, you
and they're
know,
not interested in that side. They just want, you know, famous, not in that way, but they just want to publish their books and do well.
Yeah.
Sometimes I feel like we let our authors down,
yeah,
and sometimes we've passed on a submission where I just feel we feel that we can't give them what they deserve. There's a few books like that where I feel like, you know what, I would love to be the publisher of that book because that will do so well, but it needs national advertising, it needs a massive market, it needs a financial budget of a big publisher, and we just don't have that, unfortunately. And it
that
does,
has actually happened to us. I don't want to mention the name, but it was a brilliant book and I read it really quickly, but it was quite niche in a particular geographical area that we aren't close to. And I thought, this could be massive in the right hands.
Yeah.
And I said this to the author. I said, I love it, but it wouldn't be fair to you if we published it. And I thought, I really hope she doesn't think that's an excuse, because that's the truth.
And I'm thinking back to a conversation with an author I truly respect, and I think he's one of the best writers in the genre of, you know, satirical crime, if you'd like to sort of call it that, with, you know, or hard boiled with a sort of a nod and a wink. You know, award winning, well established, but hadn't written a book for 10 years, came to us because we had a sort of a relationship through this podcast, and we turned it down because we knew that we couldn't deliver the sort of bang that he deserves.
So,
and
he was published by a big publisher.
Yeah.
And they'd unfortunately had to.
And I can't, and I still lose sleep over that conversation because it hurts so much that we're not the publisher the size big enough to deal with somebody with that track record. And it sounds counterproductive in the sense, you know, probably people thinking to this, well, if they're that good, why didn't you pick them up? Because that could have been your big, but the fact is, as we say, it's pay to play. You need big budgets sometimes, especially for rekindling someone who everyone's forgotten about, but is one of the great writers. You know, it's going to take somebody in a big traditional firm to, you know, get behind it and take them on.
And the other thing is, there's only two of us, and so there's a finite amount of what we can do for each author. So, you know, there is a point where we have to say we can't take anyone on at the moment.
Yeah,
how good you are.
It's a shame, and I think it's quite courageous as well to turn down an author that you really want to publish, because you feel that you can't do the right thing for them. I know there are plenty of publishers out there who'll say, you know what, that's going to be a big seller, we'll take it on just to get the profits. But like, I think it tells a lot about the publisher. I'm not just saying this about myself, but any publisher who says that, you know what, I really, really want to publish it, but we can't give it the justice it deserves. I think that's really credible, to be fair, of any publisher who acts in that way and acts in that manner, because that shows that they care for the author and they want the best for the author, not just the best for their bank balance.
That's true. And I think, you know, I think that's ultimately the number one motivation, is to be, you know, to do best by the author. But at the same time, you know, it's within the ecology of a company. And so the health of the company can impact on the energy, I suppose, that one can put behind any given book at any given time. I mean, if you simply haven't got the money in the bank at that point, you know, no matter how good the book is, it ain't gonna. It's gonna struggle to break through. And you know, there are periods where in publishing, this is what happens: is that, you know, it gets tough.
Yeah, and it feels like a damn squid when that happens. And it's like, oh, you know, because obviously when you publish a book, it's not just putting a book out there. You know, we have to obviously send books to the British Library. We have to send out review copies. We want to try and send out as many review copies as we want, because we want it to be out there. We want to try and advertise somewhere, not Amazon or Facebook, because that is just a black hole, let's face it.
Yeah.
We want to advertise somewhere just to give them some sort of confidence in us as a publisher. But like you say, if you haven't got the money in the bank, if you haven't got the sales coming in from previous released books or whatever, then what can you do?
Yeah,
it's hard. Well, one thing we do is so we do all our own publicity, because we have looked into hiring a publicist, and it's made our eyes water at the cost of hiring a publicist. So we do all ourselves, but we try and get our authors to do a lot as well. And we've seen that if the author puts a lot of effort into their publicity as well, sort of alongside us, then we get good results.
Yeah. But it's a tough thing, though, isn't it, Stuart?
It's almost like a partnership for small publishers. For the big publishers, it's just, I'm going to use you for money. Publish as many books as you want, we'll reap the profits. But with smaller publishers, it's more like, like you say, it's, you kind of have to teamwork in part of the publicity and the marketing, the advertising. You can't expect the author to do 100% of the work, because obviously we're the ones publishing it, and you can't expect the publisher to do 100% of the work. It has to be a partnership. I'm not saying they have to invest money in marketing and advertising. That's what we're for. That's what we pay for. But like, they obviously need the same enthusiasm and the same energy about trying to get a book out there and contacting bookshops on our behalf, kind of thing. Like, they know their local area a lot more than we do, because they might live in Scotland or Ireland or Australia. So it's just, they might have different contacts in the industry than we've got. And yeah, it's about working together to achieve the best possible outcome. So, and like you say, sometimes it works and sometimes it just floats on by.
It does. In terms of when you discover an author, I mean, what sort of conversations would you have when you're looking to sign somebody up? How long is that process?
We have a rough time scale on our website, on our submissions page now, because I don't know how long it takes you guys to respond to submissions, but we say, I think at the time, roundabout is about 8 to 12 weeks, 8 to 10 weeks. It's not a massive wait, but for people who are querying every single publisher, then it can be. I completely get the stress of emailing work to a publisher and not getting a reply for even a couple of weeks. But we've had some replies where the author are like, oh yeah, well, I've already signed with somebody else. And I'm like, well, you submitted to us like 4 days ago. Like, give it. So we've got a rough time scale. And yeah, we have a conversation about what we can offer, what we can do. And I always say to them that we can't promise you the world. We're not perfect. Nobody is, and we'll never claim to be. We can't promise you that you're going to be up there getting British Book Awards, Book of the Year. We can't promise that we're going to send you to every single book festival that's out there. We can't promise that you're going to be doing this and doing that, but we'll do our best, and this is what we can do. You know, we'll do this, we'll do that, we'll do this, and we'll do some other advertising, you know, if in 6 months' time we can afford to do this and do that. And we'll just be completely open and honest about them, about their royalties, about what to expect from publishing. We give them a rough timeline. We've got a couple of documents we send out as well, which tells them about like the entire process and roughly what will happen and when. Because obviously, when you sign an author, I guess one of their main questions is, A, how much am I going to get paid? And B, when is my book coming out? And we both know that we don't know how well your book is going to sell. So based on the royalty percentage, it could be nothing. It could be in the thousands or hundreds. It might, you know, it's whatever it is. And then when is your book coming out? It could be a good wait. So we always try and make sure that they are in tune and they're not being impatient, because obviously for them it's a massive wait, because they could have been around the book for years. They could have been querying for a couple of years, and now they've got to wait an extra, what, 12 months, 18 months for potential publication. So it's just about being honest with them. I know a lot of publishers aren't, but I know a lot of them are. And it's just about being honest with them and, you know, getting them to understand the actual reality of publishing, because it is a very lengthy process. It's not quick.
No.
It really isn't.
And I think being honest from the start is in your benefit as well, because then you don't get the email that says, Why has this happened? Or I thought my book would be out by now. You know, you stopping all that sort of miscommunication happening further down the line.
Yeah, and I think it helps build trust as well with them, because there's a lot of stories out there, isn't there, that doesn't really give you confidence in some big publishers, and there's a lot of mistrust, I guess. And like you say a minute ago, you know, those authors who have been with those big publishers who have been treated really badly and completely forgotten about, they're going to be very skeptical about joining a publisher that they might not even heard of, that they might have just come across randomly online. That's a small publisher, got a small backlist, got a small list of authors. They're going to be incredibly wary of approaching an author. So being upfront with them from the start, building that trust right from the beginning is the best way forward, really.
Absolutely. And in that spirit, I think, well, as members, all of us, of the Indie Press Network, I mean, that has, I don't know for you, but we said a few weeks ago on the podcast, once we joined at the end of last year, just how much value we got out of being part of that network.
Fantastic.
And that sense of being part of, you know, an organization where we're all facing the same challenges, the same issues, in a way that we were part of another membership organization, a much bigger one with much bigger publishers involved in it, even though they're independent, where we felt like, you know, we weren't being looked after in any fashion. So how much of a difference has being a member of the Indie Press Network made for you?
Well, just on your point about the big association, you're not the first to tell me that. You're not the first at all. So the Indie Press Network, I think, is incredible. I think I tweeted about it a couple of years ago saying how amazing it would be to have a network or like a publishers association type group for small publishers, not indies, not any publisher, just small publishers. Because like you say, we're all facing the same issues. And you know what? When we talk on the Discord group and all these problems and issues are coming up, I kind of like, I'm a bit like, oh, thank God, it's not just me.
Yes.
Yeah. Publishing can make you feel very isolated and very much alone. Even when you're firing off 100, 200 emails a day to whoever or whatever, and you're having Zoom meetings and many conversations, it can make you feel like you're on your own out there. But having that network of similar sized publishers who are going through the same issues, the same problems, I'm always like, oh my God, I'm not the only one who's struggling with this distribution problem, or I'm not the only one who's, you know, fighting against this. And I'm it sounds really bad to say, but like, I'm glad it's not just me, because
totally.
I mean, and also the sharing of people saying, I've used this printer and this worked out well for me, and I've used this one, and you know, all that stuff is invaluable.
Yeah, I don't think there's any other sort of similar organization that has, I guess you could call it a forum, because it is a forum, I guess. There aren't any others that I'm aware of that have a similar network like that, where we can talk to each other. I mean, obviously, these bigger associations have, you know, conferences, summer receptions, whatever, but it's very rare that we can actually just put a message out there and say, oh, has anyone had a problem with this printer? Can you recommend me a different distributor? Like, how do I go about doing this? And, oh my God, have you seen the price of paper recently, kind of thing? Because the bigger publishers, let's face it, they don't care about all of that. They're just like, okay, we've got money, man, we'll just spend it.
I think that's very fair.
One of the conversations I loved on Discord quite early on is about where people were keeping their books, and somebody said, well, how about under the beds? That's where I keep our stock.
That's crazy, isn't it? Can you imagine that, being on the phone to a distributor? Oh, how many covers of this you got in stock? Well, let me just check under my mattress. Let's have a look in the cupboard. Yeah, it's brilliant. And that's what makes small publishers unique. You know, we see all the time that when the bookseller publishes their British Book Award nominees, you know, they make a big fuss about indie publishers, about how small publishers, not indies, because there are massive indies out there that are technically big five these days, but small publishers. Didn't want to say them, but you will, that's fine. Small publishers are in the same boat. And, you know, there's this big fuss about how we're the ones who are taking the risks, and we're the ones who are basically leading the way, and the big guys are basically following us and watching us, what we're doing with our authors and our marketing ideas, and then basically copying them, but with a massive budget. Kind of unfair, but there we go. And then for the rest of the year, it's completely silent. Nobody cares about the small publishers. Nobody cares about us. Nobody really cares about what we're doing, what authors we're working with, what news we've got to give out. Like, there are some incredible news stories out there between all of us. And it's like, how we don't get the airtime. We don't, you know, and then once a year, the nominations roll around and it's like, oh my God, yeah, indies are amazing. Small publishers are amazing. They're brilliant. You know, they're leading the way. They're pioneers. They're doing this. And then a week later, it's like, yeah, we're kind of in the darkness again.
Yeah.
Like, that network is, I guess, crucial for a lot. Even publishers who are smaller than us, to be fair, it's crucial for a lot to help them find the light and help them find their way. And there isn't really a network like that out there.
No, there isn't. And I think that you've summed it up perfectly, the way that, you know, in a sense, the industry gives us a little shaft of light once a year and then drops us you know, as if we're something on their shoes.
Whoever's been swooped.
I do wonder. I mean, you know, this is something that we'll bring up with Will Reynard, who's been so key on this. But what we should look at is perhaps getting a campaign together within, because there's so many companies now within the Indie Press Network. It's fantastic to see it grow this way. But getting a campaign in the way that fair trade was a thing and became a big movement, in the way that organic is a big thing that, you know, that companies get on board with in terms of supermarkets or whatever. You know, buy indie.
Yeah. Hashtag buy indie.
is something that, you know, perhaps collectively we could, you know, start pushing out there, getting the indie bookshops to, for instance, if they took 5% of their shelf space was occupied by independent publishers, that would make a massive difference.
I mean, you know what they could do? They, you know, rather than stocking 20 copies of Richard Osman, stock 10 and then have a couple of I really love, I need to visit it whenever I go back up north, but I really love Blackwell's and their indie wall. They have a wall of indies. And I think that's incredible. And I think, imagine if Waterstones did that. Imagine if a big retailer, imagine if Amazon did that, if they had like an indie press section on their website for small publishers only. Like, imagine the reach that we would get. And I was saying this to someone else a few weeks ago, like, obviously, as a smaller company, not just a publisher, but a company, it's harder to get people to stick with your brand. So people will buy a book because it's Penguin. People will read, watch a film because it's Disney. But for us, it's like we do have repeat customers, but we don't have customers who buy our books because it's SRL or because it's whatever. It is a bit tricky, but trying to get our names out there, like you say, if we have an indie wall in just a handful of Waterstone stores, even as a trial, just do it for 6 months. Let's have a couple of books. Like we did with the catalogue, we all choose a couple of books each, or one book each, and we have like an indie section. And when customers go in, they can say, do you know what? I've not heard of these companies before. I'm going to read their book. And then someone might come across one of yours and go on your website, and then they'll buy more.
And subscribe to the... Because we do have a small pocket of people who do that. And they say, oh, it's another Hobet book, so I know it's going to be good. And I keep thinking, you know, if we times that by 10 or 100... Same. <That'd be> brilliant.
Same. We have customers who are, I guess they're dedicated to our authors as well, and they say, it's another whatever book. It's another book by SRL. Like, I'm going to buy it because I love the books they've put out there, or I'm going to buy them because they're environmental, blah, blah. But yeah, like you say, even if you times that by 10, it would be brilliant. Times it by 1,000. Go for it. Let's go.
Happy
Happy days, right. All the way. In Tuscany with the rest of the publishing industry.
Somewhere in Tuscany, That'd be nice.
Yeah.
Right. We've reached that point, Stuart, where we need to, you know, we've talked some really big issues here, and it's been a great deal of fun as well. But let's get to the real nub of it and Rebecca's random question.
Rebecca's laughing. What's this going to be like?
Well, last night we watched MasterChef, right?
So,
and they had a challenge where they had to pick everyday grocery item and elevate it. So my question to you is, we're coming round to your house for dinner tonight, and all you've got is potatoes plus, you know, all the basics. What would you cook?
Oh, yes. Do you know what? Right. So I trained as a chef.
Brilliant.
And
I didn't know that.
No, I've not. You don't know. And I'll say you didn't know that. And can I just say one thing? If anyone ever asks me what my favourite ingredient is, it's potato.
Really?
Fantastic.
Right, we're coming then.
The best ingredient you could ever have. And honestly, do you know what? If you came round to mine tonight and all I had was potatoes, we would have a potato salad for starter. We'd have potato dauphinoise for mains. And then I would make some sort of, well, I don't really know what potato dessert you can have, but we'd have a cheesecake or something. But potatoes are king. I could go on about potatoes all day for another hour. They're literally the most versatile ingredient you could ever have, and a potato really does elevate any dish. You can have mash, you can have roast potatoes. I'm going on again. I love literally.
Wow. I had no idea that was going to happen. I love potatoes too, and I I'm not a chef or anything, but I think out of all the things you can find in the kitchen, I could probably just about cope with cooking a meal out of potatoes. Yeah.
If I came home tonight, if I went out and I came home and all I had in my cupboards was just a massive cupboard full of potatoes, I would be so happy. I'd be overwhelmed. I wouldn't know what to do with them all.
Brilliant.
I love it.
Well, that is kismet, isn't it?
Same question to you then.
Oh, right. Okay. What would I do with potatoes?
Yeah. So I'm your cooking. Okay. We can actually act this out because I can make him cook tonight with a potato.
Post a picture on the group later.
Well, I mean, I do love a potato. And well, what did I do last night? I made so we had some leftover lamb from Sunday. Mm. So we're talking about 2 days on.
We had leftover celery, leftover carrot, leftover potato.
So it was Lancashire hot pot was what I created. and I took some care with the potatoes to make sure that they,
You got upset at the potatoes.
In what way?
Well, they didn't crisp up quick enough.
That's true. Under the grill. A little bit of cheese on top to give it a little bit of extra kick. But actually, it was really unctuous.
Yeah, it was good. Pot. And we got some for lunch as well. So we've got leftovers.
But do you know what? I think the most... There was one time I went to... when I was a reporter, a local radio reporter at the time in Sussex, and I got sent to a Michelin-starred restaurant, which was taking the first delivery of the first grouse of the season from the Scottish Highlands or whatever. So not very sustainable, but anyway. And they cooked me some lattice cut chips in duck fat. And they were the most amazing thing I'd ever eaten were these lattice crisps.
Right, okay.
And I just, thinking, the grouse was all right.
Is that what you're going to make me for dinner then? Lattice cut chips in duck fat?
No, I don't think I'll stretch to that, but... I just thought, wow. But I don't think there's anything, it's very hard to beat the perfect chip. It's very hard to beat the perfect roast potato.
Oh, well, I've got a thing about baked potatoes, the way I cook baked potatoes, which you actually like, don't you?
Mm-hmm.
So I, in the oven, obviously, not microwave, shudder,
yeah,
and olive oil and sea salt.
I do that.
On the outside. And they really crisp up on the outside.
Oh, do you eat the skins as well?
Yes, I love the skin.
Yeah, skins are vital.
Yeah,
absolutely love the skin. I've got children who don't eat potato skins, and it breaks my heart when I see them scooping out.
What sacrilege! I love a roast potato, a baked potato. Honestly, like you just said, sea salt, oil, whack it in a little bit of tin foil to cook the inside first. Take it out of the tin foil for an extra 45 minutes, and you leave it in there for as long as you want to leave it in there, and it's so crispy and so
And then just almost melting inside because the potato is so soft and just,
pretty much like that.
Okay. Well, look, we've almost spent more time talking about potatoes than we have about books, but, it is, we never expected there to be such a passion from every direction that field.
It's like when I asked somebody, the random question was, if you were to have a pasty shop, what type of pasty would be your speciality? And she actually had owned a pasty shop and I had no idea.
That's brilliant. It's like you got some sort of sixth sense of what like
I have to.
Kind of question. I'm going to listen to this back and think, oh my God, I got really excited over a potato.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that. I think
but I do wonder, I shouldn't ask a supplementary on top of the random question, which is usually the point where we bring things to an end. But I have to ask this. So you trained as a chef and now you're in publishing, and we've been talking about how long the process is of publishing. I worked in a newsroom environment for 25 years working to deadlines, and I have found that transition from that adrenaline fear filled environment where you've got to make the deadline, you've got to get the thing to the pass or whatever. No, it isn't. It's a much slower process, and I found it very hard to adjust to it. Have you found that?
But I also did 10 years of retail, 12 years of retail. I was a commercial manager. That was very fast paced and very light. But yeah, going from that to pretty much working at home is completely the opposite of what I used to do. Even going from when I used to work in the kitchen, really hot, sweaty kitchen where you're coming out stinking of fish batter and you've got gravy down you and all that lot. And then I'm here just reading books. it was a struggle to get used to it, but now you get into I used to hate routine. That's why I love retail, because one day I could be working till 11 o'clock at night, and then I'd have to get up a few hours later, and then next day my shift would be completely different, doing a completely different job. But now it's like I kind of value it because I need to look after my health more, and everybody does. And you can really get back into the things that you love doing, like the hobbies and stuff. And I now have like at least one day off a week or 2 days off a week if I'm lucky. And it's just, it's peaceful and it's calm. It's so much better.
So you could cook some potatoes on your days off.
Do you know what? I just thought in my head, I might go out to Tesco later. Get some nice, proper, chunky potatoes. I normally have. I used to go to a cafe around the corner and I used to have a jacket potato with a side of chips. How bad is that?
That is a love of potatoes.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
Crazy.
Oh, well, look, it's been an absolute joy, Stuart, to talk to you.
Yeah, and thank you.
Our great pleasure. So in terms of finding out more about the company, where can people look you up online, please?
So our usernames for Instagram, everything is at SRO Publishing, or we've got a website, sropublishing.co.uk. Pretty simple to find us on there, really.
Fantastic.
Fantastic.
Stuart, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I find it absolutely extraordinary that you would throw that question out, and it turns out that he used to be a chef and loves potatoes.
And you still haven't made me a potato dish. I'm waiting for my potato MasterChef.
It'll come.
Spread.
It'll come. Absolutely. Well, you mentioned MasterChef. Of course, it's back on. Oh, gosh, the cat's outside and meowing. And look, there's a cat flap over there, Tinky. Go around and let yourself in.
Oh, it's cute because we can't hear her, but a mouse opening.
Yeah. and then she's going to do her full stretchy thing where she runs her paws down the pane of glass. It's very sweet. Anyway, yes, MasterChef is back. And, yeah, I mean, it's just the perfect way after a busy day in the recording studio or you're at your desk doing all the things that you do to settle back and get shouted at by Greg Wallace.
It doesn't make much difference. It's either you or Greg Wallace.
Thanks very much. Which brings us neatly around to, you know, I'm not an easy person to live with at the minute, and I don't really want to go into it, but you know, I've really been very difficult, so I don't know how you put up with me.
Oh, I don't know. I just do. No, you've just been a little bit more grouchy than normal.
Yeah.
Like doors are annoying you, cats are annoying you.
Yeah, anyone on the road.
I did say
me.
To you the other day, didn't I? I said anything with a heartbeat is annoying you at the moment.
Yeah.
Like,
I don't know how I can find flies. So many targets for my ire, but I do. Anyway, it's not been the easiest. So we have Malcolm Hollingdrake's Edge of the Land out this week.
We do.
And very excited by this. It's part three of the Merseyside crime series. And it takes you right into the old Docklands of Liverpool. A lot of the action and key moments set around things like the tobacco warehouse and the clock tower that's down at the old docks. And this area is undergoing considerable gentrification. It's interesting because it hasn't managed to achieve it yet. There's a lot of money going in, and there's the new Everton Stadium being almost completed. It'll be ready for next season in that area. But the grime and the grit comes through in this.
Yes, and I like that sort of, I hate to use this word, but I'm going to, juxtaposition.
Yeah, the last time we were down there, there's a, next to the tobacco warehouse, which is an enormous structure. I think it's Europe's biggest brick building or something like that. It is an incredible landmark, and they're turning it into very posh flats at the moment. But next to it is a junkyard, a scrapyard. And I just remember looking over into that, and there was the big, I mean, it was a rat the size of a dog.
I don't remember
scurrying.
That.
Scurrying. I just, no, it just caught the corner of my eye. It was the biggest thing I've ever seen, rodent. I mean, it was enormous. And that's the nature of it. But within this story, we've got another investigation for D.I. Deason and D.S. Warlock, who are facing what appears to be a serial killer.
Yes. That's
targeting people with addiction problems.
Yeah, homeless people with addiction problems.
Across Liverpool. And, you know, it's a real credit to Malcolm, I think. The thing I would always pick out from particularly this book is just how well he, you know, the people are victims in it, but you feel such empathy for their plight and for the dignity of what they're trying to fight through.
Yeah, and there's something, isn't it,
clinging
about
to, you know, some sort of quality of life.
As they lose their lives in the book, it's such a throwaway thing, but that makes you think about their lives.
Mm.
Because you read it as a, oh, okay, that person's gone, but nobody really is going to notice or care. And that hit me quite hard, actually, when I read it. So prepare yourself for an emotional punch with this book, I would say.
Absolutely. And you presented it as part of the Indie Press Network showcase this week. Last week, and you know, that was, I mean, we had only two slots, plenty of books are vying for contention.
It was really difficult, actually. It was very difficult, but I had to pick two, and yeah, so I presented The Midnight Man and Edge of the Land, and it went okay, let's say. I mean, I was nervous, but it was fun. It was actually good fun, and hearing the other publishers present as well was good for me, you know, seeing how they do it, the differences. Hmm. In the way they,
and it just shows what a broad church.
Oh, totally.
Indie Press Network is, you know. No, well done. I mean, that was a tough thing to do. Never easy, you know. You sort of ta-da, and now Hoback, off you go. And it was the first one that they've organised, so we'll know now. Perhaps things that we would emphasise more strongly.
Yeah, or, and there were things I forgot as well, which I was kicking myself for afterwards, like. Although it didn't strictly matter so much for this one because, the idea is that it's going to be for booksellers.
Yes.
As well as reviewers and just interested people.
There weren't that many booksellers.
No. But in the future, hopefully, I mean, the hope is that booksellers will get wind of this and join in, and then, you know, it'll snowball a little bit. And I forgot to say where you can get the books from, which is kind of quite basic.
Mm.
But, you know, I'll know for next time.
Absolutely. And, just before we go, just a quick mention and a thank you to Michael Delahaye for taking us out for coffee yesterday.
Thank you, Michael. It's lovely, lovely to meet you. And, of course, David the coffee maker and his wife, Wendy.
Yeah, absolutely. And, it was just a little chat. So Michael is a regular listener to the show. He's based in Australia. He's a former BBC journalist from the class of 72, which is the same class, I think, as Jeremy Paxman.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely. So, no, it was lovely. And, enjoy your travels before you head back to Oz.
We really do like meeting some people who we come across through Hoback. So we're also meeting a lady from the Netherlands in a couple of weeks' time.
Yeah.
Who's just, she subscribed to Hoback. She reads all our newsletters. She often replies and tells me, you know, I loved the... Because I was talking in a newsletter a few weeks ago how when I took Tinkerbell to the vet, I didn't take Tinkerbell to the vet, I went to pick up her medication, and they had a giant flea model, or a flea model of a giant flea on the desk. And I thought, I want one of those for my mantelpiece. And this tickled this Dutch lady, and I wouldn't be surprised if she turned up with a flea.
Yeah, a model one, hopefully. Anyway, look, no, it's, you know, we are a Hoback community, and, you know, we really are very open to anybody replying to our newsletters, feeding back into this program as well, the Hobcast Book Show, with your anecdotes or advice or reviews or whatever it is. We, you know, we're very happy to hear from you. And this is really a program for the community as much as, you know, is for us or for our authors or whatever. You know, what we're trying to do with it is shine a light on the realities of what we do, but also the ups and downs, as I say at the start of the thing, you know,
it's just everything.
Yeah. The more we are, you know, pulling in the same direction together, whether it be readers or creators or whatever, the better.
Yes.
And, so that's really what draws us to the microphone every week. And as Tinkerbell approaches, it's time for us to wrap up. So, from myself, Agent Hobart, thank you so much for joining us.
And myself, Rebecca Collins.
Don't forget to take a look at our website, www.hobeck.net. And all we have left to say is we wish you a wonderful...
And... purry and creative...
week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the Hobcast from Hobeck Books with Adrian Hobart and Rebecca Collins. You can find the show notes at our website, www.hobeck.net. You can also use the exclusive Hobcast discount code for any of the products at our Hoback online store. Just enter the code HOBCAST20 for a 20% discount. Don't forget to subscribe to the Hobcast and feel free to contact us with any feedback. Until next time, remember our motto, Trad Values, Indie Spirit.